All right, we want to talk today about living under wealthy oppressors. We're going to be working from the book of James, chapter 5, and verses 1 to 11. You might want to turn there as we introduce the message today. Some of you perhaps have watched the last few weeks, sort of intermittently when the weather was warmer, before winter came, and now after the weather turns warmer now again, it's going to happen again. A group of people called Occupy Wall Street. And they think, evidently, that people who put stuff into Wall Street are the biggest villains. And I guess I have a problem with that because I have some money on Wall Street. It's called mutual funds. So maybe none of those people have money there. That's kind of my retirement, so I don't really want Wall Street to do bad, but these people must want to go bad. Be that as it may, how do you handle it when you think that wealthy people are oppressing you? And there certainly are a lot of people who think that rich people are oppressing them. And maybe you think the same way. Maybe you are acquainted with some rich people who haven't been very nice to you, and they've taken advantage of you. Maybe they're not really super wealthy, but maybe they're wealthy enough to own some property or something, and mistreated you, and you remember that, and you still resent them for what they did. How are we supposed to react to that as Christians? Are we supposed to join Occupy Wall Street and start a revolution? I'm reminded about these revolutions. They aren't spontaneous, you know that. They're very well organized. I'm reminded of a great revolution that took place in France many, many years ago. And guess what happened? All the rich people got marched to the guillotine and lost their heads. That's not such a good idea, no matter what you think of rich people. I'm also reminded of a revolt against rich people in Russia in 1917. And that didn't turn out so good either. Spawned a system that plagues us yet today. Well, how does the Bible want us as Christians to react towards rich people, wealthy people who oppress us? James wrote about these kind of people in the first five or six verses of James chapter 5. And he talks about rich people in James 5. Who are they? I don't think, even though he says you, I don't think he's necessarily addressing Christians, because his audience was part of the Jewish diaspora. Go back to James 1, 1 and 2. They were Christian Jews, but they were dispersed around the world. They probably weren't very, very wealthy people. And he's probably talking about the unbelieving, probably mostly Jewish oppressors who were oppressing his audience, the Christian Jewish audience. George Soros is somebody who has a lot of money. He's actually Jewish in background, but he is spending millions upon millions of dollars around the world to advance his political agenda. And maybe George Soros is the kind of person that you would think of, I really don't like what he's doing to people in our country, to our country. Maybe somebody like a George Soros is the kind of person that James had in mind when he wrote this. First of all, he talks about the mourning. He calls the rich to mourn. The mourning of the rich in verse 1, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl." Come now, weep and howl. He's saying something bad is going to happen to you, and you better look out. He speaks of the misery of the rich. "For your miseries which are coming upon you." So one thing that you can say is that if there are ungodly wealthy people, by the way, I'd like to just point this out. Having a lot of money doesn't make you evil. What did Paul write to Timothy? He said, "The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil." It's when people fall in love with money that trouble comes. And Paul in 1 Timothy exhorts the rich not to trust He's talking about Christian wealthy people. Don't trust in uncertain riches. Don't believe that your 401k is the source of your security. Don't believe that the nice house you have is your source of security. That's for any of us. Don't trust in money, because money can come and money can go very, very quickly. Come now, you rich people, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. The ungodly rich are going to have tremendous miseries that come upon them. And James urges them to weep and howl because of what's coming to them. In verses 2 and 3, he begins to describe the catastrophes of the rich people. First of all, they're going to have catastrophes in the present, the decay of their foodstuffs. Your riches have rotted. And he's talking probably about things that they've stored up as far as food is concerned. That's rotted. And their clothing is decaying. Your garments have become moth-eaten. And their precious metals are decaying. Your gold and your silver have rusted, or corroded, we might say. So in the present, these people would experience real difficulties, and their riches would not be able to save them. Then he goes to the future. What's going to happen to you in the future, you evil rich people? He talks about materialism, the testimony of materialism. Their rust will be a witness against you. He's talking about the day of judgment. The corrosion of your own metals will testify against you. The things that you have valued will testify against you. It will be interesting to see on the day of judgment, and I believe many people that think there's only one judgment day, I don't agree with that. I think there are a series of judgments. I think the final judgment, and it is described in Revelation 20, and I think that is the judgment of all the wicked dead. I could be wrong about that, but that's kind of the sense I have reading that passage. It says that books will be opened. God keeps records of all that everybody does. And I don't know what technology God's going to use. I don't think God needs a video projector to project. And I don't think he needs a screen to project and help someone's life pass before them. I suspect there'll be a lot of that in that judgment. And I think that on that day, the corroded metals that these people have valued is going to be a testimony. Why did you put your confidence in your wealth? If you'd read my word, you'd known that your wealth cannot survive for eternity. It's all going up in flames. Their rust, their corrosion will be a witness against you. The damnation of materialism, we're still in verse 3. It will consume your flesh like fire. It will consume your flesh like fire. I think that will really happen. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I think it will happen. The time frame of materialism. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. When the last days come to their completion, these things will happen. And people, rich people who are wicked people, who take advantage of others and have no fear of God, they will face a certain judgment, and their wealth will not save them. Their wealth will not save them. And they stored up in the last days their treasure, and it's not going to do them any good. Now, in the next section, letter C, verses 4 to 6, we're going to learn about the evils of the rich. Here's the things that they do that are going to earn them such terrible, terrible judgment. First of all, they withhold pay. Verse 4. Labor has been performed. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields. You owe them money. You agreed with them. You contracted with them certain amount of money to pay them their wages for mowing your fields. But these guys withheld their pay. and which has been withheld by you. You know, you introduced some fine little clause in there that they weren't aware of. Oh, well, you didn't do it quite right. You didn't get into all the corners, so you're not going to pay you anything. And their pay has been withheld by you. The damning testimony, it cries out against you. So these wicked wealthy people, when they hired people to do jobs for them, whether it was out in the field somewhere or maybe something around the home, they would always withhold something, and that withheld pay is going to cry out against these people in the day of judgment. In fact, it cries out right now, and judgment is certain to come. Now, I might just make an aside here, even though I think James is talking about wicked wealthy people. My goodness, if any of us do this kind of stuff, I don't think any of us are here really wealthy. Compared to many people in the world, we're quite well-to-do, thank you very much. Last Sunday, we showed you a picture of that church that met under a thatch-roofed structure in Africa, in Kenya. I'm confident that every one of us here are well-to-do in comparison with them. Every one of us. None of them have cars. The pastor, if he wants to get on the internet and send me an email, has to walk to a distant town to do that. He does have a cell phone. They do have clothes, but they probably don't have a lot of clothes. Many years ago, I took a trip to Ukraine in 1994 and again in 1996. In 1994, I was part of a group of Christians who went there to teach a course in Christian ethics and morality to Ukrainian school teachers in two different cities. We could never do that in America, but we could do it there. We could do it there, and we did it. And probably 400 public school teachers came, and they were encouraged by their government to come. And I had an interpreter. She wore a very nice dress. She was an English teacher in the Ukrainian public school system, and she knew English pretty well. But I noticed she was my interpreter. She'd come with me when I had small group sessions. She'd come and interpret for me. And I noticed the first day, Monday, she wore this nice dress. Tuesday, she wore the same dress. Wednesday, it was the same dress. Thursday, it was the same dress. And if you've ever been to Eastern Europe in a crowded room, you know that they apparently do not have money to buy deodorant like you and I do, because the entire room reeked of underarm odor. But that was just the way they lived. They had a lower standard of living. This woman was a public school teacher, and her husband was a lawyer. They had one small car, and they could only afford a concrete apartment building, a flat there, they called it. And I wasn't a lawyer, and I didn't ever work for the public school system, but I had a higher standard of living than they did. Most people in the world have a lower standard of living than we have here in America. May we be careful that we do not do what these people do in any way. If someone's done some work for you, you need to pay them. You pay them promptly, and you make sure that it's taken care of. So these people, these wicked wealthy people. Oh, by the way, on the fifth day, Friday, this school teacher wore her best dress. And it was nicer than the other one, but she had two dresses to wear. The fearsome judge. The outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Now, you might think that that shouldn't be spelled Sabbath, but that's not the word. That's a literal, a transliteration from Hebrew over into the Greek language. And that is a term given to the Lord in the Old Testament repeatedly. The Lord of Sebaot, that's the Hebrew pronunciation. And what that means is that is a military term. You could say he is the Lord of armies, or he is the Lord of troops. When it talks about God being the Lord of troops, you don't want to mess with him, because those are his angelic troops, his angelic armies, who fight against evil on this earth. Let me give you an example of the troops of the Lord, the troops of Yahweh. I don't know which chapter it is, but in the Old Testament, in either 1st or 2nd Kings, I think, there is a story about a prophet named Elisha. And he was the successor to Elijah. And the Syrians, see, it's just these wars are hundreds and hundreds of years old. Just as Syria today is an enemy of Israel, so Syria back in Elisha's day was an enemy of Israel. And the king of Syria would send forth raiding parties to pillage and to plunder cities in the northern part of Israel. And the trouble is, and the king of Israel would want to stop him from doing this. But actually, what the king of Syria was wanting to do, he was trying to provoke a fight, and he'd find out where the Israeli troops were, and he'd send his troops there to engage them in battle and defeat them. Trouble is, when he'd get there, every time the Israeli troops were gone. He could never nab them and slaughter them. And he began to get very angry with his own people. He says, "One of you is a spy, a turncoat, and you're telling the king of Israel where I'm coming and when I'm coming," and he gets his troops out of the way. "Who is it?" And someone said, "It's not one of us, but it's the prophet Elisha. He tells whatever you whisper in your bedchamber, he knows it, and he tells the king of Assyria." Well, the king of Elisha, or the king of Samaria, of Syria says, "All right, we're going to go nab this guy." So they go to the city of Syria where Elisha is, the city of Samaria where Elisha is, and they surround the town. That might not be the right city. It might have been Dothan or something like that. But anyhow, wherever Elisha was, they surround this whole town. And Elisha's servant Gehazi is petrified. "Master, look out the window. The Syrians have us surrounded all the way around our town." And you know what Elisha said? He said, "Lord, open up his eyes, please." And God opened up Gehazi's eyes, and he looked, and all around the town, on the hills, all around the town, surrounding the Syrian army, were the Lord's angels, chariots of fire. Those are God's troops. You don't mess with God. The outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of those troops. You don't want to mess with that. You don't want to mess with that, Lord. Verse 4. Now, what else did these, not only did they withhold pay from their employees, these guys themselves lived in luxurious housing. Their life of luxury. "You have lived luxuriously on the earth. You have just really, really lived luxuriously. And you have multiple homes in multiple places. You're really living the big life." Their life of pleasure. "And you've led a life of wanton pleasure. You didn't withhold anything from yourself. Cost was no object to you. If you wanted it, you bought it. If it wasn't very good or very moral, you did it. Just because you wanted to and you could. You lived a life of wanton pleasure. Their coming judgment. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You've lived high in the hog, but you're just fattening. You're just feeding yourself because the slaughter's coming, and you're going to be on the chopping block, and you're going to get it." Third thing that they did was they subverted the judicial process. They would always have some lawyers, you see, and they would go to these lawyers and say, can you fix this so, you know, this is the way it works? And they subverted the legal system to eliminate innocent victims. I mean, these guys were really bloodthirsty. Verse 6, you have condemned and put to death the righteous man. You've arranged for false testimony to appear and to be given in court against somebody who's completely innocent, and you've gotten the death penalty against him, and you've got him put to death. You guys are crooks. You've subverted the judicial process. Last part of the verse, the helplessness of their victims. He does not resist you. He's helpless. Nothing he can do to stop you from doing it. Now, here's the first six verses have all been how bad these evil people are, these wealthy people, how much they take advantage of the system, how selfish they are, how they live lives just for themselves. Now, they've got judgment coming. But what does that leave you and me who have to live under them? There are, by the way, in our own country, increasingly powerful people with a lot of money behind them who are rewriting our country's constitution. I hope you're aware of that. And the closer we get to the end in this country is pretty protected, but the closer we get to the end, the more that's going to be. It's not going to get better. It might. My theory about the way things go here in America is that our country lurches five steps to the left and then three to the right, five more to the left and three to the right, and five more to the left and three to the right, and there's always a backlash, but when it goes left, it goes much farther left than it ever had before, and that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing. And so you know what I'm saying. It's going to get worse. I don't want to be a fearmonger, but I'm just being realistic. I don't know how fast it's going to get worse, but it's going to get worse. There may be some breaks where it isn't as bad for a while, but in the end, it's going to go farther that way than it ever has before. So how do we live? That's the question. When you have evil, wealthy, powerful people, because wealthy people are powerful. When you have these kind of people, and they're taking advantage of you, how do you live? Well, that's what the next part of it is. The necessary attitude of the Christian. What is the Christian supposed to do? And the question is, you know, is he supposed to join Occupy Wall Street? Well, you might be fighting for the wrong side there if you do that. The thing that James is going to say is you need to be patient, and I think there's an implication there. Even though the wealthy are harassing you, you need to be patient and wait for Christ's return, and you need to live for him in the meantime. So be patient under the harassment of the wealthy until Christ returns. Verse 7, the command of patience. The command, therefore be patient. So instead of going out to join a march, you're supposed to be patient. Be patient. The subjects, brethren, you Christians now. You Christians. He hasn't been talking about Christians really in the first six verses. Now, starting with verse 7, he's talking about Christians. Brethren, the goal, you be patient, Christians, until the coming of the Lord. The coming of the Lord. That's what you look for. So, we've in our Sunday school class, we've been going through the return of Christ, a little bit of prophecy and stuff like that. The question was raised, what's the point of it? Well, here's the point. You can be patient if you know Jesus is coming back. You can be patient, and so you can endure what's happening, but you know Jesus is coming back. And he could come back today. He could come back tomorrow. There are no prophetic things that are there that have to be fulfilled before he comes back. His coming is near. Be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The word coming there is the word parousia. You probably haven't heard of that word, but sometimes theologians or Bible scholars use that. It simply means coming or presence. In my judgment, it's talking about the second coming of the Lord. In my judgment, there are two parousias. It comes in two stages. A lot of people think there's only one stage, but this is presented here as being near. So, now James is going to give you some examples about being patient. And here's the kind that we're pretty familiar with. Now, Alan Geiger, do you have a rig that big? No, probably not. That's a pretty good rig. I think they probably have bigger fields than what we have right around here, I'm thinking. But that is a farmer. He's got the deluxe of farm equipment. He's working on a John Deere tractor there. And that's an anhydrous ammonia tank. And he's got, is he knifing that stuff into the ground? Is that what he's doing with that thing? You guess? You farmers? You think he's planting? Okay, he's planting. So that's, but he's got some anhydrous going in there in front of it, right? I think so. So, this farmer, the ground looks pretty dry. In fact, I see dust around there. It doesn't have any rain right now, but he believes the rain's coming, and he's going to have to wait patiently. So, the illustration of patience is the farmer. It's a good illustration for these parts. His waiting. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil. That guy who puts wheat in the ground, he waits. If he's in winter wheat country, he plants it in September. If you're up in Montana someplace, you plant spring wheat. I don't know what time they plant up there, but they can't. It gets too cold up there for winter wheat, so they plant spring wheat. But in any case, whatever you plant, you wait for the produce of the soil. It doesn't come right away. It takes some time. You got to wait for the. You got to put the seed in. You got to put, you got the weather you have no control over. You wait for the rain to come. His patience, being patient about it. Farmers are not impatient people. Have you noticed that? Oh, they may complain every now and then, but they're pretty patient. If they were too impatient, they'd get out of the business. You see? They stick with it. And his reward until it gets the early and late rains. Now, James was coming from a Middle Eastern background, so you get rain, you start getting rain in October, and it goes, and then you maybe dries up a little bit, but then you have latter rains around February, March, April, somewhere there. So they're looking for the early rain and then the late rains. They're looking for their stuff. And I'm sure they have planting seasons that are based on their rain there in the Middle East. But the farmers wait. They wait for the early rains. In our world, you get your seed planted in May or whenever, April, whenever you plant corn, and you want some rains in May and June. And we always know in July and August it gets hot, and it's really, really neat when you get a nice rain in July. That's really, really, really helpful. It can be $1 million rain. The application of patience to the Christian. First of all, the need for patience. You too, be patient. Just like farmers in our part of the world are patient, we Christians need to be patient, even though evil, wealthy people might be taking advantage of us. We need to be patient. And we need inner strength. Strengthen your hearts. In other words, don't get discouraged. There are some things that we have to do ourselves. We need to strengthen our hearts. We can't afford to get depressed when things go to pot around us. We have to take courage. There's something we can actively do not to become discouraged. We need to take a God view of things. Don't take a human view of things. That gets discouraging. Strengthen your hearts. And the motivation is the imminent return of Christ. For the coming of the Lord is near. Once again in verse 8, verse 7 and verse 8, two references to the coming of the Lord. That's what gives you motivation. You know Jesus is coming. Let me give you an example from the real world of school. About this time of year, kids in school are kind of getting tired of school. Okay? Even the ones who like it are getting tired of school. And they're looking for that day in May when it's the last day of school. And they figure if they can hang on to May the 20th or whatever it is, I don't know what the day it is this year, they can do it. Okay? Well, that's the same way with us. We're going through hard times now, but we're looking for the coming of the Lord. And His coming is near. The coming there again in this verse is parousia, same as it was in verse 7. So the coming of the Lord is a motivation for us to keep on persevering, not get discouraged, but to look for Jesus to come. That is a it's biblical. We're looking for the return of Jesus. It's called our blessed hope. Our blessed hope. Now, let me just give you a little bit of information about this parousia thing. The coming, parousia of Christ, verses 7 and 8, is presented as being near. This evidently is speaking of the coming of Christ for the church before the tribulation period. This is presented as an imminent return, meaning there are no events that must precede His return for the church. If you read Matthew 24, there are all kinds of signs that have to be fulfilled before Jesus comes back. But the way this is presented here, it doesn't go through, oh, by the way, before that comes, this is going to have to happen, this is going to have to happen. This doesn't happen in this passage. This is one of those passages, I think, that's talking about the return of Christ for the church. If you don't agree with that, you think He's coming at the end of the tribulation, doesn't make any difference. You still motivate yourself by looking for the coming of the Lord. Here's a parallel passage, Titus 2, 11 to 14. I would encourage you to memorize this passage, by the way. Grace, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men. Godly, live a godly life. Instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly, that literally means sanely. Most people live insanely in this world. You and I as Christians ought to live sanely. Righteously and godly. There's the key word, godly in the present age. God's grace has appeared, bringing us salvation. We need to live godly lives in this present age. Glory. Looking for the blessed hope, talked about that, and the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Christ Jesus. All the tough things we go through now are like nothing compared to the glory that's coming when Jesus comes back. Man, looking for His glory. And good, who gave Himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for Himself a people for His own possession, zealous for good deeds. There are four G's there. We need to be living that. We need to be living those four G's. We need to live grace. Accept God's grace. We need to live godly lives. We need to look for the glorious return of Christ. And we need to be doing good deeds. That's the Christian life in a nutshell right there. I encourage you to memorize this verse, commit it to memory. And I encourage you to memorize it, and I encourage you to live by it. I don't very often suggest you memorize verses, but this is one I suggest you memorize. I don't care if you're 92, I encourage you to memorize it. You say it enough times, and you'll finally remember it, okay? Now, verse 9, the push for patience, the warning. Do not complain, brethren, against one another. The reason for the warning? So that you yourselves may not be judged. That sounds very much like what Jesus said in Matthew 7. Do not judge, lest you yourself be judged. The nearness of the judge. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. If you complain against Christians, and maybe even complain against those wicked, wealthy people, better look out. The judge is right at the door. You start judging other people, you're going to get judged too. The point. Mistreated Christians are therefore, in view of their systematic harassment from the rich, urged to be patient until Christ comes, who is known as the judge. Not only will Christ judge the evil, wealthy people, that's implied, but he will also judge the persecuted poor Christians. So the persecuted poor ought not to be too critical of the rich or of one another. Okay, the examples of patience. First of all, the prophets. Verse 10 and 11. The example, as an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. If I had time, I'd talk to you about some prophets. I'm running out of time. But remember how Elijah was serving the Lord and Jezebel said, I'm putting a 24-hour bounty on your head. May I be cursed if you don't become like one of those false prophets you just killed. And Elijah ran for his life. He didn't give up, but he sure panicked. I don't blame him. The commendation, we count those blessed who endured. You admire people who stay true to Jesus under persecution. You admire that. Another example, Job, the guy who lost his kids and everything he had. The patience of Job. You have heard of the endurance of Job. And have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings. That the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. All right, let's wrap this up. Some life lessons from this passage. Leave the wicked wealthy for God to judge. He'll take care of them. You don't have to go join a demonstration. God will take care of those evil, wealthy people. Secondly, patiently wait for the coming of Jesus. Third, don't complain against your fellow Christians. The judge is almost here. Patiently endure suffering. Count on the Lord's compassion and mercy. Now here's the message in a nutshell. When we encounter opposition, we should trust in the mercy of God. I'd like to give you a couple of illustrations in closing. There's a man who was piloted a B-17 bomber during World War II. And as usual, they were barraged by flak from the Nazi anti-aircraft guns. On this particular occasion, their gas tanks were, their fuel tanks were hit, but there was no explosion. They couldn't believe it. When they landed, the pilot told this guy, it wasn't quite that simple. He said the pilot, whose name was Bond, had gone to ask the crew chief for a shell as a souvenir of that bombing raid, their unbelievable luck. The crew chief told us that not just one shell, but 11 had been found inside the gas tanks. 11 unexploded shells, where only one was sufficient to blast us out of the sky. It was as if the sea had parted for us, even after 30 years. So awesome an event leaves me shaken, especially after I heard the rest of the story from this pilot. He said that the shells had been picked up by armorers to be defused. The armorers told him the intelligence had picked them up. Why? He couldn't say, but eventually he found the answer. When the armorers opened each one of those shells, they found no explosive charge in them. They were clean as a whistle and just as harmless. Empty? Not all of them. One contained a carefully rolled up piece of paper. It was scrawled in Czech handwriting. No one knew Czech. They finally found somebody who could translate it. The note read, "This is all we can do for you now." You need to trust in God's goodness. You go through hard times, but He's got His hand of protection out for you. One more story, something about Abraham Lincoln. He did some business with a friend of his named Barry. And business was very, very slow. And the friend Barry said, "How much longer can we keep going like this?" And Lincoln said, "I don't know. It's getting pretty tough." He says, "You know what I'd like to do? I would like us to be able to sell stuff, and I'd like to be able to pay off my debts and just go to law school." That's what I'd like to do, but I can't afford it. If I just had enough money to buy Blackstone's Commentary on English Law, I'd be a happy camper. I'm translating in a modern language here, okay? So a wagon came up the road, and the guy on the wagon said, "Look," says, "we're pretty short. Can you buy this barrel from us?" And Lincoln looked at the eyes of his wife with her pleading eyes, and the guy asked 50 cents. Now, 50 cents is nothing today, but back then it was a big deal. So he said, 50 cents for that barrel. Lincoln, "Okay, I'll take it from you." Gave him 50 cents. And he was dismayed because it just seemed like a bunch of nothing in there. But he reached the bottom of the barrel and he felt something solid. He drew it out and it was a copy of Blackstone's Commentary on English Law. He began to study that, and that changed his life and changed the history of our country. I'm saying that God takes us through hard times, but we need to believe that God's compassionate and gracious. He's got a good plan for us. He'll bring it out. If we'll be patient, keep looking for the coming of the Lord. Let's bow in prayer. Lord, I pray that you'll bless us. Each one of us has experienced injustice and has not been treated fairly, maybe sometimes by people who have more money than we do. Lord, help us not to get bent out of shape, but to trust in you. You'll take care of those people in the right time. Help us not to be critical, but to remember that the Lord, the judge, is near. Let us keep one eye fixed on him, and let us always hope in your goodness to carry us through whatever trials we have. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. All right, would you take your hymn?